Hey, welcome back to the podcast, Printavo's Print Hustlers Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce from Printavo. Thank you so much for being able to join us today. We've got a really special guest coming up, Jacob Goodman from Fresh Prints, who they're doing just about $40 million in sales as a shop. And so we're going to dive into how that worked. They bought a really small shop when they got started and really cranked it. I mean, they cranked it all the way up to be able to get it to where it is today. But real quick, a couple things. Number one, Print Hustlers Conf 2022. It's going to be a lot of fun. Printhustlers.com, November 5th, 6th, and 7th, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Got a ton of awesome stuff planned. Check it out, printhustlers.com. And then number two, GraphicSource is a proud sponsor of Print Hustlers Conference and the podcast. If you guys need a solution to improve efficiency and reduce costs in your art department, check out GraphicSource. They offer industry-leading outsourcing options for your shop to truly become a part of your team. A lot of actually Printavo shops use GraphicSource pretty heavily, mainly for separations, mock-ups, creative work. I actually just use them for that. Some order management. Steven's using them for store creation, digitizing, and customer service. So give them a check. That's GraphicSource. Make sure to mention Printavo Pod for the 50% off your first order too. Easy Way. You shouldn't be spending all day cleaning dirty screens. Easy Way's line of environmentally conscious chemicals will get the job done faster and more efficiently, and will cost you a fraction of the cost per screen. We appreciate you. Check out Easy Way. Next up, Multicraft. If you haven't heard of Multicraft_Daddy, and if you need ink supplies or daddy, Multicraft screen printing and digital supplies have been supplying the industry for over 50 years with top brands at competitive pricing. Also, again, Printavo Pod, another discount, 10% off. Check them out. They're a really awesome supplier, and Dave is great to deal with as well. Give him a follow. Last but not least, Supacolor. This is kind of different. Supacolor actually sent me this really cool PDF that they want to be able to share with everybody. So check this out. Basically, think about this. How can you heat transfer high color counts, gradients, and hard to print locations in a bunch more different tricks and tips? Well, actually, Supacolor created this PDF that they sent over that has a big, long guide to all of this stuff. Check it out. Supacolor.com/printhustlers. Or click the link in the description and you can be able to see it. Not only that, they've also got a really cool pricing guide to be able to help or, you know, just to be able to show you how to price with heat transfers properly and for the most profit as well. It has different types of transfers. It has how to pick a quality heat press. There's a lot of good stuff, hopefully to save you guys time and money. So again, supacolor.com/printhustlers. I was pretty excited about this because I love just sharing all kinds of education. So get it down in the link in the description below. All right, let's jump into the episode. All right, Mr. Jacob. Today we've got Jacob Goodman out of Fresh Prints. So I actually saw an article in entrepreneur.com magazine that said, this is the title, "These college kids bought a custom t-shirt company." I love when the media always uses custom t-shirt company. with their bar mitzvah money, now it's a $40 million business.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
At first, actually, also, I think when we first started running Fresh Prints, the custom, labeling it as a custom t-shirt company also kind of always made my skin kind of boil a little bit, but now I've embraced it.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I remember just being into tech and everything as a kid. I was always like the IT guy for the family. It was like, okay, Wi-Fi broke. All right, cousin called. I can't turn on my laptop. It's like, dude, I don't know why your laptop's not turning. Reboot it. Turn it off. Turn it back on. Take out the batteries. Yeah. Do something, you know. But for sure, then you turn into the t-shirt guy when you have a shop, and that's the natural promotion.
Yeah, exactly. It was a great. We were really appreciative of Entrepreneur for reaching out, diving in with us, writing that story. It was really humbling, and I know it felt good for all of really our team to kind of have that recognition. And really, yeah. I mean, there's so many people behind Fresh Prince that have put in a lot of work and effort. So it was definitely a cool moment.
Does that type of media, like mainstream media, help? And I mean, it feels like for our team at least, so we did the Inc. 5000 thing, right? I think that helped a lot in two ways. One, for the internal team to see, like you're saying, it was really cool. And then also for recruiting. So it looked legit. Like, oh yeah. I mean, you know, if you're applying to a company and the company's like, yeah, we're in the screen printing space. And you're like, huh? You know, and then, but, oh, they're on the Inc. 5000. Like it brings some sort of, oh, okay, cool factor to it. Did you find the same thing or was there more?
Yeah, that's all, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it's always been a huge debate internally. Like how much emphasis should we put on PR, or like PR kind of feels like a distraction. Like it doesn't really fundamentally improve our product or our offering. It doesn't fundamentally like help our customers in any way. It doesn't fundamentally help our employees in any way. Like, is it just all for show and vanity? Like that's a serious conversation. And is this just wasted time and resources? And we've seesawed on that over the years. And I think historically, like if you look at the company's history, we've invested less in PR than most companies of our size. I think even a lot of people saw that article and they were like, wait, 40 million? What? Where did you guys come from? Mm-hmm. You know, we've been around for, you know, 10 years.
That's interesting. Was that the thought of like, I mean, and I see some shops do it a little bit more locally. I don't know how much of your sales is local driven versus national, which maybe actually, how much is it? Because that also plays a part too, right? Because if it is, you know, some shops are maybe 80% within, call it a 50-mile radius, you could see some benefit that may bring, you know, if you're doing some sort of local events or charity work or a cool new client, things like that. But how about you guys?
Yeah, we're definitely not what I would describe as either local or hyperlocal business. There's no pocket of the U.S. that has like a disproportionate percentage of our sales. So definitely nationally distributed. And you know, we really have two key markets, and one of those is the collegiate market. So, Greek life, collegiate administration, collegiate orgs. That's one key area of the business. And then the other is, the corporate market. So corporate gifting, corporate swag, corporate merch. Customers all over the country. So no particular region that we focus on.
So I'm going to read a quick paragraph from this article. Fresh Prince bought a failed clothing company that sold fraternity, sorority, and college branded merch. After pulling $16,000 together, kind of familiar story, we pulled together maybe $8,000, I think, to buy. It was just equipment, though, basically. Today, they have over 625 campus managers to grow sales and have hit 40 million in sales with 290 full-time employees. That's a big operation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually a little bit dated now. So it's.
Oh, really? What's the updates?
The headcount's now almost 400 full-time.
Holy cow.
So I think the interview for that was four or five months ago. I actually don't remember the exact interview date. But we've continued to hire through. Yeah, we you know, it's the part about buying a failing business was probably a little harsh and not the best way to paint it for the founders. So I don't know if I would say that it was actually the business before it was failing. It was definitely, it was a fledgling business, and there was like no real infrastructure. It was really just the two founders kind of trying to basically broker t-shirt deals on their own. And then we bought it from them with my business partners, bar mitzvah money. And it was kind of off to the races from there. So, but yeah, almost 400 people full time, the, you know, 600 campus managers. And that's really been a lot of the foundation for the business.
I'm pretty curious as to buying the business versus, you know, starting from scratch and how you think about that. But, you know, jumping into today, actually, what is the corporate structure look like to manage a team that size?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's no kind of like silver bullet. It's really tough. And I think honestly, the hardest part is not even just managing the size, but managing how quickly the size changes. Because inevitably what that means is every couple of months, we have to reorg the organization, layer people, add new layers, introduce new managers and new leaders. Those could be promotions from within, which is where we tend to be very, very pro and big on growing by promoting from within versus hiring externally. So it can be promotion from within into people who are first time leaders, or sometimes we do hire externally and hire leaders with leadership experience. But regardless, every time we basically have to reorg, it's like very, very jarring. So the basic way it kind of works is, organization A within the company grows, headcount's growing significantly. Everything starts to break. It starts to get in shambles. And then one of our senior leaders will say, hey, this organization needs to be reorged because the old structure that was working there, the organization's now too big for it. We reorg it. We try to rework it and get everything back on track. And then like inevitably in 3 months, the same thing will happen with that same organization or like some other organization in the company. So,
but what are like the departments? So is it like, there's a sales team, there's a marketing team, there's a,
yeah,
so, you know, account, yeah, management team, what?
Sales, product. So there's tech product and physical product, art, which is all of our designers, engineering, operations and supply chain, which we call logistics. Trying to think of if I'm missing anyone. We have of course, a pretty robust licensing team, finance team. I really want to make sure I don't miss any team because then I'm going to get
really watching this. But okay. So 290 to now 400, like how do you add, you said this article was like 6 months ago or something. How do you add 110 people?
I mean,
in six months,
it's brutal.
Is it? All right. Well, so there's two questions, right? Like one is, where is that growth coming from? And then two, what breaks down? Like, are they mainly account management, sales, or just everything?
Yeah. There's no like one single team that I just listed where it's like the overwhelming majority of our company is overrepresented in this department. So like most of those teams that I just like, if you actually look at all those teams, I mean, besides like finance is a smaller team as a headcount percentage or as a headcount number than most of those. And the licensing team is a smaller headcount team, but the other teams in terms of headcount are fairly similar in terms of size. So there's not like one single team where it's like, we are extremely heavy in X and this explains like 90% of our headcount. That's not the case.
But then is all the growth from the Greek side? Is it from the corporate side? Is it both?
All of the above. So like both sectors of our business have been growing quickly. Corporate is growing even faster just because that part of our business is younger. And I think there was like, right, like, you know, we had been around longer in collegiate. We had captured more of the collegiate market. And like as of a couple of years ago, our corporate sales were really insignificant. And so just as we built out our corporate offering and our corporate gifting program, those sales in that organization has naturally grown a lot. And yeah, I mean, my guess is that That's going to be a very significant part of our business for the years to come, and is going to continue to be a very high growth part of our business.
And so, where do the sales come from a marketing perspective? Are these organic? Or is it like, hey, we're turning up Google Ads, you know, way higher? Or are you like jumping from campus to campus? Or is it a lot of outbound? Like, what is really drive? Like, what is the engine here?
Yeah,
that's what I find fascinating, right? Is like the with behind the growth, it's like, what's the flywheel that helps continue to drive it? And, yeah. and I know it could be like a combination of things too, but
yeah. So I mean, there's always pretty much anyone that asks this question in like any interview, like, will always be pretty open about the fact that there's just a component. Like, there's a component of it in, I think, in any company where like some of it's just like the secret sauce, and it's like, okay, some of the exact initiatives that we do, like, we don't really talk about that much just because there's stuff that we've developed in-house. We've put a lot of effort and a lot of time into it. Sure. And, you know, it's just not stuff that we go about talking about.
Makes sense.
But I will say, like, I think the obvious one thing that I can say, and is like, I'll share in any interview, I think people always want to ask, like, okay, like, what's the demand engine? Like, where is this all coming from? And yeah, how do you power the growth? And I think that, obviously makes sense that people want to know that. And one of the obvious takeaways, of course, is that it is a very, very much so an omni-channel, which you alluded to, a very much so an omni-channel approach. Like, it's not like we just have one channel where I'm like, okay, yeah, we just spool up Google Ads and like, that's where everything comes from. And if you spool it up, right, like a lot of demand is going to come. There are a lot of different levers that we have to develop and press on and actually make sure are working together in tandem. In order for it to really work well, I think marketing and demand gen does have to be a robust function.
Got it. So, and it's kind of similar for us, right? There's Google Ads, there's just general SEO and ranking well in Google. There's retargeting ads, there's email, there's downloadable things. We don't do really any outreach, but that could be a channel too. But that makes sense, right? To all have to work together, hit people a couple of different times to be able to.
And I've seen that,
close those deals.
And I also have seen that, like, right, like marketing is something that's like very context specific for each company. And like is very almost culture specific. Like, you have companies that are just like, you know, any like just outbound just doesn't fit with their culture, and they don't do manual outreach, and like that works for them. Right. And then you have companies that like traditionally, let's say, like haven't really focused on SEO and are maybe just doing paid search, or they're doing paid search and manual outreach. I don't know, some combination, and that really works for them. And, I do think that you see like kind of every successful demand gen engine, every successful marketing team, they do have an omni-channel approach, though. They are saying,
sure,
we have multiple levels that we've
even companies on. Smaller. Absolutely, it makes sense, especially because it could be measured so well with the tools and everything today. You know, with this journey from buying a shop for $16K to today, what do you think were the company's revenue breakpoints? You know, it's like where things really had to shift. I feel like maybe around closer to $1 million in sales is like, okay, we need to start to get things in line. Then maybe $3 million was another interesting one, in that we need to get true managers in place. I can't do everything. Maybe the next big one. So that sort of structure scales up until like 10, and then maybe at 10, it's like secondary level of management. And you know, where do you think for Fresh Prince it was those different, like, oh crap, this, you know, Rubik's Cube has to be like rechanged again to put it back together. And then what did you do?
Yeah. I mean, so almost on some level, right? Like that was kind of what I was saying at the beginning where, you know, and even now it feels like as we add headcount quickly, the reorgs come very fast, right? So like finding something that breaks. But like in terms of like moments where it was like, oh shit, things are really breaking. Mm-hmm. I remember when we got to like $8 million, we had to install a layer of management and revenue growth slowed down for a minute. And our, you know, up until then we had done like 50 to 100% growth every year. And really every year since pretty much we have too. But in one particular year, I forget the exact year it was, but we were about $6 to $8 million in revenue. Growth just like really dramatically slowed to like 15 to 17%. And 15 to 17% growth is, you know, great, by the way. But just in the moment when the context was we had put so many years of 50 to 100% growth back to back, 15% didn't feel so great.
For sure.
And we were wildly below our projections. Yeah, and it was a moment where like we just had to install a sales leadership layer. And
that was at $8 million?
Around $8 million, yeah. And
what do you mean by sales leadership layer?
Just sales management. Yeah. So like we had a lot of you know, our sales reps that were reporting to me, Josh, and Yolite at the time, who are you know, my two partners, and we own the business. And I mean, we got to a point where they couldn't roll up to us anymore.
You guys did the $8 million.
Yeah.
Holy cow. I feel like that would, how many people were reporting to you guys? Although I guess it was three. So maybe you could split it up into three.
We could split it up, but it was a big number. I forget these. I mean, we pushed it further than most. Like I know.
What type of manager did you hire then? Like, was it like a seasoned sales rep? Was it internally?
I mean, I remember it. So it was like one of the worst moments of the company's history. Like, I remember it so vividly. We went through like, I think I went through like seven or eight people in a row who like they either quit or we had to let go of. It wasn't like I let go of all eight. Like it was just, I had no idea how to hire for this role. And so I kept on messing it up. And I at first was looking for people with some sales management experience, hired them, then just said, okay, that didn't work. Maybe I just need someone with sales experience that I can groom into a manager, hired some people with that type of profile. I hired people in similar industries. I hired people with, I tried everything. And
what would you say now, like now that I'm sure, you know, you've got the lessons learned from it. If somebody was in a similar situation, what do you think are the characteristics to hire better in the first or second time for that role?
Yeah, it's kind of cliche advice, but like, instead of a specific skill set or a specific profile, like I think the best hiring advice is always hire a missionary, right? Like hire someone who, and for us, you know, a big part of the mission has always been the campus manager program and enabling student entrepreneurship. And so like finding someone who that mission really spoke to and like, was all about Fresh Prince's culture, was all about what Fresh Prince was setting out to do, and was really talking about the culture and the mission of the company in their interview. Like that, those people end up almost always being the best, right?
Got it.
They're just really bought in.
What about like management experience? Do you think that would help to contribute? So maybe one characteristic for sure is how much are they willing to self-solve problems and just drive forward and push forward in that, you know, missionary category?
But like the question is like, how much do we value someone with managerial experience, and like how?
Yeah, because I mean, you think that, right? Okay, so there's either two routes. One is somebody who shows some sort of management opportunity, and you want to be able to give them, you know, the chance. But it sounds like you already have quite a few sales reps that are reporting up to you and your partners. So my default thinking is, all right, it sounds like somebody who has managed, you know, many people, can be able to help see around the corner and make less mistakes. I don't know what, like, is that true or what did you find?
I've always been skeptical to like comment on it so much, because it's never like I have ran a rigorous study of like, here's who we've hired, and here's their success and performance with that came in with management, and people that we hired that came in without management experience.
Yeah.
And like actually like separate those two cohorts up and look at it. I mean, it could be something that we looked at. It's a little hard. It's a little hard to control for every variable.
I wonder if like a better way of me asking is like, what do you think of the characteristics that you found in that person that worked that made them good? So one you said is they're definitely missionary. Are there some others?
Being a missionary is like head and shoulders above everything else.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
If you're going to get that right and everything else wrong, like you're probably good.
Got it.
Like for the most part, right? Like, yeah, sure. Like ability to learn quickly, like 100%, right? Like that's a huge one. Like if it doesn't matter like what someone knows or doesn't know, if they're like ready to learn and they can learn and they've demonstrated that they can learn fast. The problem with that one is like you oftentimes don't really know that until you hire someone. So like you just kind of have to evaluate that on the fly, and figure that out. But yeah, ability to learn is I would say probably is number two. I mean, like this kind of goes in line with being a missionary. Like, I think you get this because you're a missionary, but like unrelenting tenacity, like that's almost every role, right? Like there are some people who at the first sign of trouble will be like, hey Jacob, this is never going to work because X, Y, and Z, like, fill in whatever excuse you want to fill in, right? And then like they're using that excuse and a justification as a reason to stop pursuing the problem, right? And then there are people who are like, I will not rest until this problem is solved, period. Like that's just who I am. Like I see the problem, I've set a goal for myself, like regardless of what challenge is put in front of my face, like I will solve it, I will get past this challenge. Like those people are remarkably effective in any company and any organization that they join. And when you can find someone with like unrelenting tenacity, like you grab them immediately, right? So I mean that's a huge one as well. But where does that tenacity come from? It often comes from because you're a missionary and you deeply believe in the mission that you're trying to solve, and you believe in it so much that you're willing to work 12, 14 hour days to go after that goal and that endpoint, right?
Yeah.
So like, I think it ultimately all ties back to hiring missionaries. But yeah, I mean, like the ability to learn, tenacity, like those are another two key characteristics. It's really, really like, I'm not saying like, I know how to screen for these skills like with a high degree of accuracy. It's really freaking hard. Like I think screening and hiring is without a doubt, bar none, the hardest thing to do in a business. Like
is there a question that you found that helps detect for being a missionary?
No, honestly, I wish there was. Like there's not one. Like you really just have to like listen intently and like try to get as many data points as you can on someone. Like how many interviews can you do with them? Like how many reference checks can you do with them? And like, how good are those reference checks? Are they people that have worked with them really, really closely and like can speak to their work product and their work ability? You know, those are the types of things that you really want to do. Mm-hmm. But no, I like everyone else, I've been looking for the HR silver bullet for, you know, 10 years, and I'm yet to find it. So, if I do find that HR silver bullet, I'll I guess maybe I'll quit Fresh Prince and write a book, and that will be the most bought book in history, but I'm skeptical I'll ever find it.
Do you guys print, do you guys contract everything out, or do you print in-house or combo?
We contract pretty much everything out, yeah.
Got it. Has that always been the case, though, or did you, was that like the, was that a transition?
Yeah, pretty much always. I mean, we've had conversations about like if we've wanted to bring stuff in house. But look, I mean, the truth is we have a lot of respect for our printers and the like just how technical it is and like how much you have to invest in terms of resources. And, you know, you have to have really skilled labor. You have to know what you're doing. And, like, print quality is something that's easy to mess up. We have a lot of respect for that. And so, like, whenever we've, like, had a conversation about bringing it in-house, we're like, wait, like, it would be kind of arrogant for us to believe, like, we can just, like, do this and, like, set this up and make this work. Like,
for sure. Is that a lot of work.
Is that really the smart thing for us to do? Or like, is it much smarter for us to say like the actual printing itself, like this isn't our core competency. Like we should surround ourselves with really good partners who it is the
right, core competency. Right. And
that's really the approach we've taken. It's another thing where it's like, I don't think there's one specifically right answer. I think it's company specific. I think it's context specific. I've heard companies that said like, hey, we brought it in house and it was transformative for our business. I've heard companies that said, never bring it in house. Like we brought it in house and we like blew up. Right.
Sure.
Like, I don't know if you remember like famously kind of like the Teespring example.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah. Like, yeah. No, we've had the founders on the show to talk about it. I mean, it was hard.
I think they were always pretty open that like they raised that round. I think it was from Andreessen or Coastline. I forget who it was. And like, they like, you know, raised a bunch of money, opened that huge facility. And it was like, I mean, I think they, from what I heard, it was really, really, really difficult for them. And was really distracting. I know Teespring's doing well now.
I think it's definitely underestimated. Did you guys fundraise at all or no?
Mm-mm, no. People were obviously always egging us to, and we always, saw a path to build the business without fundraising. And we figured if we could, we should try to pursue that. And that'd probably give us a lot of flexibility and, be fewer cooks in the kitchen about like, it'd be easier to get, you know, just me and my other two partners aligned on long-term vision than
sure.
a bunch of people and a large cap table of investors. So, I think ultimately like it made it hard and painful in the beginning. And we had like, you know, for a long time, very few resources to do a lot of the things we wanted to do. But I think in the long run, it's definitely been good for us.
I see from your website, it looks like you guys have your own branded gear, it appears like, that you push certain knits, these cool like Greek polos and things like that. And at the top actually it says retail too. So is this like a separate business? Is this like, or do you push this for on the wholesale side? Or because like I see you could buy one, like a Terry shirt, for example, you could buy one for $41. Well, what's the thoughts of this business?
Yeah. Yeah. So we always, it's definitely not separate. It's just a part of the Fresh Prince brand. And we've rolled it into the company and, we put a lot of work, into, like I said, kind of at the beginning, our fashion and product team. That's really our tangible product team. And for us, like the calculation was kind of simple. Like if we're going to be thought leaders in the space and we're going to continue to power the growth, like we can't just be a custom apparel company. Like we need to be a custom apparel and fashion company. We need to develop our own product. that product has to be, it's really hard, but like that product has to differentiate us, has to speak to current trends, and like has to speak to our audience in a compelling way where we have an offering that is very defensible and unique and makes us thought leaders in the space. We always knew that would help us create more brand power, capture more brand power, and make for a long-lasting company with a very powerful offering.
How's it been going? Obviously being, it's interesting, right? Because bringing printing in-house, kind of different business. Retail, kind of a different business too, but it sounds like aligns more with like what you're saying. With the stocking design, cut and sew, all this stuff. Is it been going good or is it new still or what?
Yeah, it's actually interesting you say that, because then you could also, right, you can make the same argument I just made about, like you said, printing in-house, where it's like, okay, well, can we actually pull this off? Like, can we pull off developing, designing our own garments from the ground up? Those same questions still existed, but we just felt like it was too goddamn important. Like, we were like, we have to develop our own product. Like, we need a product that Fresh Prince contributed to the world and created and like we're known for, and we have to create a company that can consistently release new product that's compelling. So like, it's not like we can just develop one product and be like, okay, we're done. Like, we have to create, like you said earlier, and we were talking about demand engine, we have to create a product engine that like can self-sustain. And now, we do two product releases a year, and anywhere between 4 to 10 lookbooks a year, which is, another expression of product creation and thought and what we want to be thought leadership.
So is it like going, does it feed the wholesale side as far as, okay, garments? So it's less of really one-offs and it's more of, hey, these are really cool new items. Do you want to buy 100 for this event or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, so our we want to push on both levers, right? Like, we want to also develop that retail side. And we think like, if we can develop that retail side, that unlocks a whole new part of the business that is meaningful and can be really interesting and compelling. Yeah. But also, on like the decorative side, actually pulling down styles and trends that haven't made it to the traditional distributors like an Alpha Brother or an SMS.
And that allows you to be competitive in a unique way because, for example, this rugby crop tee, super cool looking. I don't think I've seen this on.
Yeah. So like, right. Catalog. So like our product team is, the goal is like for us to be inspired by current trends. And like it's kind of obvious why, right? Like the way that our industry works is something gets hot in retail. Every retail brand like squeezes it for every single last piece, for every last dollar they can. And then once it's no longer hot, it goes to one of the distributors that everyone buys from, Alpha Broder, SNS, fill in the blank. And by the time it makes it into their program, no one gives a shit about the product anymore because mm-hmm. the retailers already squeezed all the juice out of it, mm-hmm. right? So we're like, okay, well, then we're trying to sell these products 3 years later that everyone's like, wait, where were you guys? Like, this was cool many years ago, right? And remember, we're selling, like, our biggest market is collegiate. So, like, trend is really important. Like, what are people wearing on TikTok and Instagram, right? Like,
sure.
That's very meaningful to
be able to sell direct and figure out. That gives a bit of an edge. That's pretty interesting. And are you stocking this stuff too in everything? Holy cow. Because like some of these products, have, if I click on this one, there's three different, no, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 colors, small through extra large. You're talking 32 variations.
It's as terrifying as it sounds. it truly is. So when we that's why when we started doing it, I kind of looked at our part, you know, our business partners, we kind of looked at each other and we were like, is this crazy? Right. Are we going to blow our brains on this one? Right. But yeah, I mean, that's just one of those moments, right, where it's like, there's no, like, you can do as much modeling as you want. And we did tons of modeling. Right. But like, ultimately, if one of those inputs is like way different than what you thought it was going to be, you're left holding the bag, and like the model doesn't matter. And none of us had really any historicals to know what those inputs would be. So yeah, just like, it's a huge bet. It's a huge swing. It could have been really painful if it didn't go well. And, you know, we were obviously planning and putting ourselves in a position of like, okay, how do we contingency plan for what happens if it doesn't go well? And like, how do we make sure we're making a big enough bet, but not a bet that's too big that it's like really, really, really painful. Right. And that's what we tried to balance, right?
Do you follow any sort of business leaders out there or interesting books for owners or leaders, or what do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I actually have some relatively strong opinions here.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
So favorite management and leadership book, like hands down, is High Output Management, like without a question. Have you read High Output Management? Or
no, I'm adding it right here.
Yeah, it's a great book written by Andy Grove. Was written in the, I think it was written in the 80s. I don't think it was the 70s. I think it was written in the 80s. Pretty unbelievable staying power. Like, still a lot in that book is like very relevant to today. And whenever I have a new leader, that is like required reading. And you know, if someone says they want to be a leader or a manager, I make them read it. And if they don't, then I know they weren't that serious about being a leader or a manager. Read it multiple times. I think every time you'll get something new out of it. I've always also really, really liked, Keith Raboyce has a great lecture in Stanford's How to Start a Startup class, I think the title of the lecture is How to Operate. And it's a fantastic lecture. Like he actually references High Output Management a lot. And you know, he's very open about the fact that a lot of his like source material does come from Andy Grove and that book, but he has a lot of new ideas to add as well that Andy Grove doesn't cover. And that's just a great lecture. And I mean, you know, from everything I've heard about Keith Raboyce, he's like pretty great manager, pretty great operator. So I know he's been successful many, many times over. Another management one is, I mean, those are really like have been two of like the core source material for me for like a while now that I've really loved. Matt Mottery has like a great open sourced, Google Doc. That's like basically a guide for, I was about to say first time founders, but not even first time founders, just like any founder or leader.
Matt Mottery. How do I spell that?
Yeah, MattMochary.
Okay.
I think it's called The Great – it is called The Great CEO Within. And he serial entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. He's now an executive coach and have coached a lot of – or some of the most prominent startup CEOs of, you know, the past 10, 20 years.
Here's the book. And the great CEO in Google Docs, pull it up.
So completely free. Anyone can go pull it up and read it. He opened it up, and that's a great one too. John Doerr wrote a book called Measure What Matters, which is great. And that gives a lot of insight into OKRs and how to set them and using OKRs as a goal setting framework. Andy Grove is actually, now OKRs are like everywhere. Like everyone talks, especially it seems like the last 10 years, like literally every company uses OKRs. But
and for the folks that don't know, OKR stands for objectives and key results. And basically the whole premise is you want to be able to give a result and let people create. Oh, wait, is it the other way? It's like one where basically you set the goals and then people create the stuff to hit the goals, which is.
Yeah. So the basic idea is right. Like the problem with like traditional goal setting or KPI setting is like, you set a goal and you set a number and like you're catering and you're working towards a number. But the question of like why this number matters is often unclear. It's like, well, the number matters because the CEO said it was an important number.
Right.
It's like, okay, that doesn't give us a lot of context. And like that doesn't enable people to actually march towards something meaningful. And also it's not very inspiring, right? So like, are people going to get up every day excited to run through a brick wall for just like a number on the screen? Probably not. So what the OKR framework does is it identifies the objective, which is usually the qualitative, like where are we going, right? Like what are we actually trying to accomplish? And then the KRs are the measurable quantitative.
The key results. Number. Yeah,
exactly. The key results are what you can actually measure. That if you satisfy the KRs, if you satisfy all the key results, you should structure the OKR in a way where the objective is satisfied.
And so then there's like actions underneath that help you accomplish the key result. And then you can do it like what's interesting is we've been doing it and each team will have them. So basically, an objective for marketing, maybe we need to drive X amount of new leads to the sales team. And then the leader there creates the key results and measures it. And, you know, and then the team underneath could be like, all right, if the key result is this, I need to create, if that may be my objective, let's say I work on the marketing team. Well, one of the key results could be, you know, profitably drive 100 leads this month. Okay. How am I going to do that? So then my key results add up to the 100 and, you know, and it can kind of break down the tree again and again.
But yeah. So that's like the beauty. That's another like, great part that John Doerr talks about a lot as well. In Measure What Matters is having objectives and key results allows you to actually like plot the OKRs of each of the company, each team within the company. And then like you can theoretically, like as large as your org is, continue to set them up. Right. And smaller sub teams can have them, and you can go and you can set them all the way down to the individual level. Right. And then you could look up and make sure that like all of those goals are actually aligned, and like one team's goals that they're setting don't clash with the company's OKRs, or one team's goals don't clash with another team's OKRs, and that there's actually like full alignment, and you could see it across the entire company. And a lot of times, right, like especially as companies get bigger, goals, you're going to find scenarios where goals don't align. Right. And so this allows you to like actually easily kind of see that and, be like, start asking questions. Hey, what's going on here? Why doesn't this line up with what this other team is working on? Or why don't these OKRs line up with the company's OKRs? And, what do we need to change to get back on track and to get alignment? So that John Doerr wrote a great book about it. Andy Grove was actually the one who invented and is credited with inventing the OKR framework. And John Doerr worked for Andy Grove. I don't remember how long for, but I know he did work for Andy Grove at Intel and really learned about the framework there. And then famously brought it into Google. And I think once Google really started adopting OKRs, then like you kind of saw really a lot of others adopt them as well.
Cool, Jacob. All right. I think this is a good episode. I think there's a lot of kind of cool tidbits in here. Is there anything that I missed that's unique about Fresh Prince?
I'm one of the owners, so I think there's a lot unique, but so I don't know if I'm the most unbiased opinion. But yeah, check us out. I mean, freshprince.com, and always welcome anyone to shoot me an email. My email is jacob@freshprince.
Cool.
If you want to connect, and appreciate you having me on, Bruce. It's great to chat, and thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Hey guys, thanks so much for listening to this episode of Printavo Print Houses Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce from Printavo, Mr. Jacob Goodman out of Fresh Prints. You can find that article about them too if you just search freshprintsentrepreneur.com and be able to pull it up. All right, I'll see you guys on the next episode. Later.